Whoop, whoop. Good Tuesday morning, everybody. It's a short week, fellas. We've got the 4th of July weekend coming up, and
yes, sir.
You may or may not have something to do on Friday when everybody has the day off, and then Saturday on the 4th of July. You may need to have an alternate plan B depending on what we get to this weekend, because it looks like some stuff may be closed up by the time we get to the holiday weekend.
Well, I don't have to have a plan B. I wasn't going to the beach any damn way. So that part of it, you know, they can't stop me from hanging out in my backyard or one of my family members' backyard or one of my good friends' backyard. I'm glad that they closed the beach. And as far as I'm concerned, they could close the beaches for the rest of the summer and the regular bars for the rest of the summer. I understand that economically it will impact those bars and some people in terms of that, but it also impacts people's health, because when you have idiots like Raj running around and not conforming to rules of the CDC, you know, this is what you do.
And you can come down here, Raj. I don't understand. Bars and beaches are wide
Travis,
open. Come on down.
I'll be down there all 4th of July weekend, baby. I'm down there.
I don't understand. Well, listen,
I went through the dispensary. I went to the dispensary. I made some rather good purchases. So I'm going to be at the beach. I'm going to be at the museum. I'm going to be at the Grand Canyon. I'm going to be on the moon. I might be at a waterfall, Niagara Falls. I'm going to be on tour.
So I'm all set.
I'm going to be in a good place. I just went to the store. Started buying some of my food for the 4th of July. You know, so that's already marinating. You know, I've already got it soaking and marinating now, and it's like Tuesday. So by the time that hits the grill on Saturday, it's just going to fall off the bone. Like, boop, 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 boop. I got my Hamilton gear, so I'm going to be doing a sing-along. I'm going to be watching Hamilton on July 3rd, live streaming on Disney Plus, and then I'm going to wake up, and bam, I'm going to start grilling. So I'm set. I'm happy. I'm chill. I'm going to try and keep my mind focused on what's up and not what's down. Or I might be down and think I'm up, depending upon how much I smoke. But
that's a man with a plan right there. There's a lot going on. LZ has got it all figured out. That's good news. The Lakers guys are expected to complete the signing process with J.R. Smith later today. They'll submit his name as part of the Orlando restart, basically taking the spot of Avery Bradley on that roster. And I guess this is what the training camp is for. I guess this is what those 8 games before you go into the playoff season is for, to try to acclimate your players. And maybe in the case of J.R. Smith, to really evaluate exactly where he is, because he has not played in an NBA game for nearly 2 years. Last time he had played in NBA action was November of 2018, which is not just a few days ago. I mean, that's nearly 2 years ago. I know he's played a lot of basketball, a lot of championship basketball, but to not play NBA basketball for nearly 2 years, that can't be nothing. That's got to be something that you got to knock some rust off, I would imagine.
Yeah, it you know, when you look at it, that's the only thing that really concerns me, is how many minutes you're going to give him and what are you expecting for him to do, because he's had a long layoff. He's 34 years old, okay? We've seen older guys still have some juice left in the tank and contribute to teams. I'm not saying that he can't contribute at 34 years old, but what I look at is, I look at the last time that he was on the floor. I would say he wasn't, you know, I know his career as an NBA player has been pretty good, but toward the end of that career, toward the end of that Cleveland run, here's a guy at the shooting guard position. That's what he does for a living. He's supposed to be a shooter. He was only shooting 34% from the field and a mere 30% from deep. And so when you look at that, averaging 6 points a game, okay, if you give me those 6 points, if you give me those 6 points in 10 minutes, then I'll take that, right? I'll say, okay, that's good. And you raise that shooting percentage and you raise that deep three percentage. We need you to knock down one or two big threes for us a game. Do you have the confidence that he'll be able to do that? Do you have the confidence at 34 years old his legs will be underneath him for that 10 minutes?
I don't have a problem at all with that stat about his last year with Cleveland. I don't have a problem with him taking 2 years off, because I know who he's playing with. And while you certainly can look at the stats and go, he's not giving you much, he didn't shoot that much, you have to remember the construct in which that season was happening. That franchise was in disarray after LeBron James left. Complete trash. That tends to be a reoccurring theme when LeBron James leaves you. You're garbage. But especially in Cleveland. Remember the first time he left Cleveland, they wound up with the number one overall draft pick. 3 out of the 4 years, he was gone. Like, that's how they were just, like, They were just one of the best teams in the league. He leaves, and they got the number one pick in the draft 3 out of 4 years while he was in Miami. That's how dynamic he is. And so when I think about the percentage that J.R. Smith has, I also know that a lot of those shots either came at the very end of a shot clock or he was playing one-on-one basketball because the team was in a disarray and there was no true leader. So he was just jacking up shots.
Now well, I was going to ask you, though, LZ.
Now he's back in a structured offense, Keith, with LeBron James. He knows how to play off of LeBron James. No one's going to be asking him to break a defender down and then get to the bucket. No one's going to ask him to create his own shots. All we want you to do, you see that corner over there, bro? Stand over there. Because if you stand over there, they have to respect you. They have to respect you. If they don't and they disrespect you, I'm going to give you that rock. And I know for sure you can hit an open three-pointer all day long. That's not what was happening in Cleveland. In Cleveland, he was being asked to create his own shot, or sometimes he was being stupid and trying to create his own shot in bad situations. Now he's back to play smart basketball. I just need you to stay on there for 15 minutes a game so that I have space to operate. He's going to be perfectly fine. I'm excited.
Well, I was going to ask you if LeBron James took the shot to L.A. with him, but you astutely have explained yourself and why you feel the way you feel about J.R. Smith. I'm just merely saying that when you look at the end of that era or that run in Cleveland, his shots were not going down, whether he was getting them at the last second. Because the last second guys are supposed to be able to knock them down. Shooters, when you think about the shooters in this league, that's what they do. Last second, you kick it to them, they just right off the wrist. So I understand what you're saying. But at the same time, those numbers do say something. And I'm not even a numbers guy. I just, with my eyes, can see things and remember things. And then when I go to the numbers to back it up from a factual standpoint, because, again, we are the show of the people and we like to have facts on the show. Yeah, throw things against the wall and stick. And so with that being said, I look at his last few, you know, months in Cleveland. He just wasn't knocking down shots. And then you put on top of that, 2 years removed from the game at 34 years old, we're not dealing with a Vince Carter situation,
right,
where the guy continued to play, you know, and then play. You're dealing with a guy that was chilling for 2 years.
Well, it's like, look, I understand that professional athletes are in a different category from regular everyday guys. I understand that, and I understand that J.R. Smith is probably keeping himself in a level of physical fitness that is different from even a regular guy that keeps himself at a high level of physical fitness. But anytime, like, if you're just doing something, and I'll use this as an example, that even when I was playing baseball a million years ago, if I was just pitching, I could pitch, you know, every fifth day and never really think twice about it and just keep going and keep going and keep going. And as you get older, you just kind of keep it going and it's not that big of a deal. But even if you stop for a summer, for instance, or you start over a Christmas break and you took 2 or 3 weeks where you just stopped doing something, those first couple of weeks back, or maybe even a little bit longer than that, there's a certain level of fineness that has gone away, just a little bit the ability to locate the ball, the ability to spin the ball, maybe some blisters at the end of your finger, just all these little things that happen really, really quickly when you stop playing. And this isn't a guy that stopped playing for a couple of weeks. This is a guy that stopped playing for a couple of years, practically. And I understand that if he can get it back, it's not a matter of will he be able to get it back or not. It's a matter of how much time on the clock there is to try to knock off that rust and get back into that highest slice of professional competition, what the NBA is. And then on top of that is NBA playoff competition. So I get that he's that guy, that he's a guy that's played in these games before, but I don't care who you are. If you just sit around for a while, and I'm not talking sitting on the couch eating potato chips and slugging beer. I'm talking not playing in that environment. You're going to get some rust.
And that's all I'm saying. I'm saying the same thing you said, Travis, sitting around not playing 5-on-5 basketball at an up-tempo level, an NBA level, is certainly going to be interesting. But here's what I would say. Now that everybody else has been sitting around for, what, 3 months now?
Yep.
3.5 months? So maybe now that everybody else has kind of been sitting around, maybe if the feel comes back a little bit, you know? And so we'll see. We'll see. I'm excited for him. I'm excited that the Lakers were able to find somebody that they're comfortable with to bring to Orlando and replace Avery Bradley. So we'll see. We'll see what it boils down to.
Yeah, as I said, I'm not really worried at all. If we wanted him to come in and play like 25 to 30 minutes like a starter, then I would be concerned. But we're asking him to be Jordan Farmer. We're asking him to be Sasha Vujicic. We're asking him to come in, keep the floor spread for about 10 minutes a game, and because people know that you're a shooter, and if you get hot, you might not eight down on them before they even notice what happened, they'll respect you. And so we just need someone who can continue to keep the floor spread. When it gets down to crunch time in the fourth, you're going to have our guys who've been here since day one of the season. You're going to have either KCP or Alex Caruso paired up with Danny Green. It's likely not going to be J.R. Smith unless he's knocking down that jumper. So I'm not really worried about it because he may not be able to give you a great deal, but we're not asking for him to give you a great deal either.
That's really it's the idea of him being out there at the end of games. LeBron has his guys, right? J.R. Smith is one of those guys. If he does come in and has a little bit of whatever he had the last time we saw him, I wouldn't be surprised to see him at the end of the game, LZ, especially because, like he just said, if we're all starting over, by the time they get back on the court, it's going to be 4 months. And so if he can work his way in there and he's got that hot hand, I wouldn't be surprised to see him out there in front of some other guys.
Yeah, listen, JR's a flat-out fantastic streak shooter. And once he gets going, you know, he's really hard to slow down. So if he gets in one of those rhythms, he's going to be there in crunch time. And if he doesn't have one of those rhythms, then someone who's more used to the structure of their offense, whether, as I say, whether it's KCP, whether it's Alex Caruso, who's finding himself at the end of games a lot anyway, then, you know, you're not going to notice that JR wasn't on the floor in the end of the fourth quarter anyway.
All right, the Dodgers are the favorites to go and win the World Series in a 60-game season, but there's not even a close to a guarantee that they get into the playoffs. We'll explain next. That's coming up on The Morning Show on 710 ESPN. 60-game season starting at the end of July, and the Dodgers and the Yankees are the heavy favorites coming into a shortened season. I've been trying to articulate just how risky a 60-game season is in Major League Baseball because you can be the best team, and the Dodgers almost certainly are that, and miss the playoffs easily. And it's not just me being a doomsdayer. It's not just me saying, oh, hey, get ready for the Dodgers to blow it again. The math tells you that it's very, very likely. 60 games over the Dodgers' seven-year run, right? 7 years in a row, the Dodgers have won the National League West. 60 games, they would have won the National League West twice, and that means five times out of seven they would have missed it. Now, they would have gotten into the playoffs two other times as a wild card under that scenario, but basically we're talking about a team that's been one of the best teams in baseball for 7 years in a row, a team that's been to the World Series twice, a team that's had deep playoff runs multiple times, being outside of the playoff picture at 60 games three out of seven times, more or less a 50-50 shot. If that doesn't send a cold shiver down your spine as a Dodger fan, I don't know what else to tell you, because being good is not good enough over 60 games. You have to get a little lucky, and you have to be very, very hot, or you're cooked.
Well, that's what I was saying the last couple of days. Remember, we were talking about this, and I was like, you're going to have teams like San Diego and San Francisco in the mix, you know, because it's such a shortened season that all of a sudden the best teams may be in trouble because the teams that are not so good, you know, have historically played their best ball in the beginning of the season, and for whatever reason, the slow starts with the better teams has always been there. Then all of a sudden they catch fire after All-Star break or heading into All-Star break, and then they roll into the month of October. Well, if you look at the shortened season now, that 60 games, you know, that halfway point is still the beginning of the season. And when it's still the beginning of the season, you'll mess around and have the Padres and the Angels in the World Series or something. Think about it. And I've been saying that the whole time, right, Travis?
No, you have. The problem that I have, and the problem might not be the right word, but the concern, that's a better word. The concern that I have is there is no way to simulate from opening pitch, we have to go. From the opening pitch, we need to approach this like it's September 1st and we're in a one game we're one game ahead or one game behind in the playoffs, where every pitch matters, every at-bat matters, that baseball has been played for a million years, and it's this slow, deliberate process that plays itself out over six months. And the whole idea of don't get too high and don't get too low. The worst thing you can do as a baseball player is go into a series, a game, an at-bat with a this is it. You have to push really hard. This isn't football where pushing hard helps, where dialing it up the intensity helps. In fact, in baseball, it's probably the opposite. That probably hurts. And you have to just kind of play the game. And over the course of a 162-game season, your ability, your teammates' ability, will be more or less than your opponent's. Over 60-game, it's just not true. And you can't just say, okay, we're going to change it. I don't worry about the manager. I think that Dave Roberts and Joe Maddon and all the other guys that manage these teams are going to go into spring training with the understanding of we're basically in a sprint from the opening pitch. But the players are an entirely different concept. You can tell Cody Bellinger and Mookie Betts and Max Muncy and all these guys, hey, look, this is different. But they've never had to do it differently. It's one thing to intellectualize it. It's another thing to go out there on opening day, that runner at second base, and you got to move him over like it's, you know, the bottom of the eighth inning in October. It's a totally different dynamic. It's a totally different feeling. And I don't know if you can simulate it and create it out of thin air.
It'll be interesting to see how you set your lineup based on that, right? I mean, do you set it the same if you're the Dodgers, or do you – I don't know. I don't know how you do it, because much like you're saying, how do you simulate something that you've never done before? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you got to get up, or is it you stick your toe in the water and get a feel in those first several games? And if it ain't going a certain way, you tweak the situation. Are you messing with your pitching rotation? Are you messing with the lineup in the batting order? Those sort of things.
Well, think about it. Think about like a guy like Gavin Lux, right? The guy that is scheduled to play second base for the Dodgers. He is a high-level prospect, a guy that the Dodgers have an incredible amount of faith in, a guy that has actually played pretty well at the big leagues in the limited time that he's had. Let's say he has a bad 2 weeks. Do you hook him? Do you sit him down? Do you put Kike Hernandez in there starting every single day? Or do you have to – because under normal circumstances, you'd never consider putting a guy on the bench after 2 weeks. These are not normal circumstances. This is why Dave Roberts and Joe Maddon and all these other guys have an incredible job ahead of them, a very difficult job, and more than anything else, a very different job than they've ever been asked to do before.
Well, this is the reason why, though, I just feel as if the Dodgers are best suited for this moment. Like – given everything that's happened to this team in between that series against Houston to today, the core of the unit, we've talked about it. I've talked about it 1,000 times. This core unit have all the battle scars, all the battle scars on the field. Then in the offseason, they find out that Houston cheated. All right. So now they're sitting there like going, man, we were robbed. We were cheated, blah, 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 blah. And you pick up Mookie Betts, so you're fired up about that. They got so much going on. I just feel as if this is the one team, I mean, the Yankees too, obviously, but the Dodgers, because of the battle scars, this is the one team that can't wait to get out there and validate everything that they've been going through. Go out there and prove they are the best team of this generation, of this era. Go out there and prove that Kershaw is the best pitcher ever. Go out there and prove that they are who we thought they were. I don't worry about – if this was like 2 years ago, maybe I would have been worried. It just feels as if they remind me so much of that San Antonio Spurs team that lost to the Miami Heat in the NBA Finals when Ray Allen hit that three to help force overtime, and then they went on and lost in 7 games. They came back the following year on a mission because of the wounds and the battle scars and the feeling they were robbed and all of that. And they were focused from the gate, and they drove that thing all the way home. There was no slow start, is my point. And I feel like the Dodgers are there. I feel like they know they've been robbed, that they had all these opportunities, that they got the best player, and they're going to come in locked and focused. They're going to go. They're going to win 40 plus games. I don't care what Vegas says.
That's
I don't
a lot.
Care.
That's
I know a it's lot. A lot. I know it's yeah. a lot. I'm going big. I'm going big, Travis. So big.
Well, okay, here's another one. David Price comes over with Mookie Betts, right? And I think that David Price is a fine pitcher. I think that David Price was kind of some really hidden value there. I know that he was thrown in because he makes a lot of money and the Red Sox were looking to get rid of some of that money. That's fine. I think David Price is a good pitcher. But he may get off to a slow start. If you're Dave Roberts and Dave Price goes out there and has a couple of rocky starts, and let's say the Dodgers are just kind of floating around 500. Let's say they've played 15 games, which, by the way, is a quarter of the season. I mean, think about that. 2 weeks is a quarter of the season. You play 15 games. The Dodgers are 8-7 or 7-8. They're just kind of floating around 500. And one of your guys, just let's say it's David Price. It could be any of them. One of your guys just got rocked twice in those 15 games. Do you run him back out there? Do you just keep doing it and hoping that the sample starts to figure itself out? Or do you have to go down and say, all right, Dustin May, you're in here. Or Tony Gonsolin, you're in here. You got to do this. These are the decisions that would never have to be made on this timeline that will absolutely have to get made on an accelerated timeline under this one. Because 2 weeks is a quarter of the season. That's just absolutely. I can't say it enough.
That's why you stick the toe in the water. But this, you know what this does, though? It also elevates the managers. For so many years, people always said, oh, the 162 games, the managers 10 games. They win you 10 games, but they lose you 100 games. You know, this now puts the managers and the skippers in a position of not necessarily power, but puts them in a position of thought. They've got to be well thought out. These analytics and all that sort of stuff, that could go out of the window now. This to me, falls in the manager's hands to be able to construct a winning team to try and get to a World Series. So, Dave Roberts, if you're listening, let's go.
They got the right guy there. I agree with LC that he's the right guy for the job, but you're right, Key. The analytics are out the window for sure, because analytics matter over thousands of data points, not over hundreds, and you're going to get dozens, not even hundreds, dozens of data points in a 60-game season. All right. Everybody was pretty excited about Cam Newton going to New England, but there's one guy in particular that didn't like it at all. I'll tell you who it is next on the morning show on 710 ESPN. Cam Newton is a New England Patriot, and you've heard they're going to win the division, to they might go to the Super Bowl, to they're going to win another one without Tom Brady, to they're going to be all right, but it doesn't make a huge bit of difference. But so all across the map, the one person that was not particularly impressed with all of this is Richard Sherman, who was absolutely appalled by the amount of money that he was going to make with the Patriots. What he said was, how many former league MVPs had to sign for the minimum, asking for a friend? Just ridiculous. A transcendent talent and less talented QBs are getting $15, $16 million a year. Disgusting. So it's not hard to figure out what he's getting at. He's saying, look, Cam Newton, former MVP, transcendent talent, why is he getting pennies on the dollar where other guys who have done nothing in this league are making a couple of, you know, $15-16 million a year? How did that happen? How is Cam Newton playing for $7.5 million of incentive money?
Well, I think it happens for a number of reasons. The Carolina Panthers released Cam Newton at a time where, you know, I don't think it was vindictive. I don't think that, and when I look at it, I don't think the Panthers was vindictive in doing this. I think what happened is they got caught with Matt Rhule. They signed Matt Rhule. He made a decision that he wanted to evaluate Cam Newton. He wanted to get all the information on the injuries. He looked at everything with the staff. They processed it. And as time went on, they wasn't 100% sure they was going to get Teddy Bridgewater. So it was almost like we had a safety net for Cam, because we obviously knew that Kyle Allen wasn't the answer. But if some reason we don't get the quarterback at free agency, we're holding on. We're going to hold on to Cam. And time-wise, caught up to the free agent situation. Everybody filled up their roster spots. The pandemic hit, exploded on us. People couldn't get a hands on Cam, look at him. So now you're at the end of the tail end of free agents. Just like when you get to that bag of bread and all there left is the end piece, you got to make a decision. Do I go out and get a new loaf, or do I figure out how to fold them two ends together and make it right? And that's where Cam was at. He got to the end, and he tried to figure out how to take the front of that bread and the back of that bread and make a sandwich. And what was left of it was the New England Patriots. New England Patriots, historically, they just don't do deals in favor of the player. That's just what they do. And when you look at it, it's a situation where they sell to you. If you Cam Newton, they say, look, here's what we're going to do. We got $1 million of real money, but we got likely to be earned incentives for you. And we know you're going to be the starter. We know these are the sort of things. You're going to get to that money, and you're going to be able to prove to the NFL on a try-me deal that you are healthy and you're the guy. That's what happened. And you say, well, what about the other teams? Again, there are no other teams that make sense without creating something outside of football. There is no creation on Jared Stenham and Brian Hoyer. But if you put him behind, I don't know, the Cleveland Browns, which I would have signed him if I was Cleveland. But clearly Cleveland's not ready to move on from Baker Mayfield. Because if you put him behind Cleveland and Baker Mayfield, the moment that Baker Mayfield stubs his toe in those first two games, you go, man, you the guy. And you roll with it, and Baker Mayfield is out. They could have done that in Chicago. But Chicago didn't trade for him like they did Nick Foles because of familiarity, not sure about the injuries, blah, 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 blah. And you say, well, Nick Foles was injured. Yeah, Nick Foles was injured. But the coach knows Nick Foles. So there's a huge difference with that being said. So when you look at it, there wasn't a lot of options. You know, the Pittsburgh Steelers comes to mind because Ben Roethlisberger missed some games here and there. He's known to miss a few and then come back and drama queen and all that. But when you look at it as a whole, man, this is a good situation for Cam, money aside. So, I understand what Richard Sherman is saying. But
that's what I was going to say, Key. What is Richard Sherman saying? Because he obviously understands the economics of the league the same way that you do. And what you're saying makes perfect sense. But what was Richard Sherman getting at, saying that guys like Taysom Hill makes more money than he does? Marcus Mariota, who really hasn't done much
in the NFL, making
more than he is.
I wish Richard in his statement, in his comments, would have clarified why Cam Newton got this money. And I would have put more of a negative burden on the Carolina Panthers opposed to the league as a whole, because the Carolina Panthers are the franchise that held his rights at the time that big money was being spent in free agency. So when you look at that, they let him go too late, but I also understand why Carolina let him go too late, because they was trying to hold on to something.
There's no underlying motive, because I keep going back.
I don't think that there's no underlying motive. Cam Newton was a $100 million quarterback, one of the first $100 million quarterbacks that we've seen in the National Football League. So I don't think that there was any underlying. I think he got caught at the end of free agency in a money situation. So really, as far as the salary cap goes, the New England Patriots is an organization that's always up against the cap. That's why you always hear pay cut, give me the money, incentive-laced deals with the New England Patriots. And then when you look at the fits, you got to look at the fits. Who else? Let's say, for instance, give me a team that's just need a quarterback, but they really bad.
I mean, Cowboys.
Miami.
So think about Miami. Paying Cam Newton $20 million to go to Miami to do what? To lose? I'm Cam Newton. I don't want to go down there and lose. Well, why would I want to do that? So you know, just bet on yourself.
The thing that's kind of crazy to me, though, is that Travis, your initial question was it done on purpose? As if there was some vengeful spiteness. And at first glance, what Keyshawn's saying is right. The timing, what they thought they may be able to work with, the new coach coming in, you can kind of make sense. What doesn't make sense to me, though, is something as simple as the social media post they had asking for the greatest player in their franchise history. When you do something like that, that makes me wonder if there was some sourness between the two parties. And it wasn't simply, we're trying to figure out what we're going to do at this position, as much as we want to screw you over because we're now mad at each other. And I can't help but wonder why, if you're the Carolina Panthers and the decision you made to move on from Cam Newton was business driven, why then would you diss him in such an egregious fashion? Like, to me, that just suggests that something else besides just football was at play with the decision to release him when they did. I don't think it was a social media intern or second year employee of the franchise that just absentmindedly forgot to include Cam. You don't forget Cam Newton was your quarterback.
Man, everything that you're saying makes sense, but if you're the Carolina Panthers, do you try to, based on a new era and all that, do you run that game? Oh, it's a new era. We're moving on. We don't want to. Do you run that game that we want to talk about?
No, because the question wasn't who's the best player on the team this upcoming season. It's who's the best player in franchise history.
Nothing to talk about except.
Exactly.
It's only two players in my. Well, it could be three. It could be. Cam, Steve Smith. Well, it could be four. Cam, Steve Smith, Luke Kuechly, and Julius Peppers. Those are probably the four in my thought process right now that would be the top
and
four.
And Cam was the one guy that's left off.
And he's the
number one. And Cam is the guy that's playing for peanuts on another team. Cam's the guy that was just kind of in limbo for a period of time. I hear what you're saying, Key, and the economics of what you explained make
Maybe.
But there also seems to be some level of vindictiveness in all of this. And put this, if
maybe what happened, though, Trav,
out, like,
maybe
eh,
what,
whatever.
What, maybe what happened, Trav and LZ, is there has been a problem that occurred after or leading up to free agency when they kept holding on to him. Maybe that was some stuff that happened internally that we don't know about or haven't heard about, because I can't see where they would do that disrespectfully had they not held on to him for so long. Holding on to him, Carolina shouldn't have did that. They really shouldn't. They should have made their mind up fast to let him get into free agency. That's typically what teams do. They let Greg Olsen go quick. You're right. He went on and signed on with Seattle. That happens. People don't sit around and hold on to players that they have no intentions on not keeping unless there is some salary cap ramifications on letting him go. And from what I understand, there was no major salary cap implications to the Carolina Panthers if they let him go at a certain time.
Well, that's the reason why I just wonder what happened.
You know, something probably happened during the whole holding on to free agency. I'm sure Cam told him, you know, how he felt, and some of that probably happened. Knowing that he was getting ready to be released, he probably shot at him and said something that they didn't like.
So, you know, while I don't agree with Richard Sherman's approach in terms of how he kind of compared all the quarterback salaries, because the timing for everything is off, it does make sense when you ask about, you know, the treatment of their star player, the treatment of their franchise player. He kept you relevant for a decade.
Absolutely, 100%.
Well, it's like, I understand this isn't apples to apples.
They haven't been as relevant since I left.
Exactly, Keith.
This is not a perfect comparison, because one guy had won 6 Super Bowls and went to 9 of them, but the other guy did go to a Super Bowl. The other guy was an MVP. And look at the way that the New England Patriots dealt with Tom Brady when he decided to move on. And look at the way that the Carolina Panthers moved with Cam Newton. And I get it. It's not Cam Newton and Tom Brady are different players with different careers, but there's a way to have one of your, you know, most iconic players in your franchise move on and have it seem like, oh, okay, this is what it is. This is what happens in pro sports. And then there's the way that Carolina did it, which is like, wait, what? He's leaving, but you didn't even put him in this silly poll. There's a little smoke there. I don't know what the fire looks like, but there's definitely some smoke. Oh. All right. Okay. It is Tuesday. It is 6:40, which means, LZ, you better have your top 10 ready, because that is coming up next on the morning show on 710 ESPN. All right, LZ, what do you got for us today? What's the topic?
Well, gentlemen, you know, this summer we've spent a lot of time talking about Mike Tyson because of the videos that he's been putting out there, you know, asking whether or not we want to see him come back and yada, 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 yada. Well, today is Mike Tyson's birthday. And yes, I know. Very exciting. And one of the things that, you know, always just blows my mind, especially when I started working for DAZN and really started to see physically what some of these guys look like, was that at 20 years old, he became the youngest heavyweight champion of the world. And if you can remember your body at 20 and how you were still trying to grow into your man muscle, your man body, if you will, and this dude is the best fighter at the heavyweight division, it was just absolutely phenomenal. So it got me thinking about all the young phenoms in sports and what they did once we discovered them and how their careers panned out. So this is my top 10 list of young sports phenoms. I got some boxing, I got some tennis, I got some basketball. So let's get rocking. Coming in at number 10 is the kid. And the only reason why Ken Griffey Jr. is not higher is because at the end of the day, he's the only one on my top 10 list that didn't reach the mountaintop in terms of a championship. Mm. He's got everything else, you know, all-star appearances, golden gloves, bronze gloves, silver gloves, whatever you want to. He's got everything. But he doesn't have the ring.
He is the most natural-looking baseball player I've ever seen in my life. He's the only one that made every single thing he did on a field, hitting home runs, catching fly balls, stealing a base, doing everything there is to do in baseball, and made it look just flat-out easy. Even Mike Trout, who might be the greatest player I've ever seen, doesn't make it look easy. Griffey did.
Yeah, that swing is so smooth. Just flawless.
I know. Beautiful. You know, it's so crazy. You guys like Griffey. You know, when you think about it, you're like, man, you want him to win a championship. You just wish he was on a team that could deliver that championship for him, because that's the one thing in all of his career that at the end of the day, we always had this conversation of his beautiful swing, his stance, the shoes, just everything. And then we say at the end of the day, damn, he ain't even win, huh?
He didn't even win. Mm. And he is one of the few to hit number 600 clean.
Yep.
He did. Tried to right. Going back. Gone! Home run! Can't beat it! 3-1 cripple, and he got it out. Number 630 for Ken Griffey Jr., number 19 on the season.
Absolutely phenomenal. Number 9. Number 9 might actually hit Travis in the right spot. We'll see.
Okay.
Chrissy Everett.
Oh.
I know he might have been a Tracy Austin person. Yeah, I don't know.
Well,
that's a surprise to be on the list, right?
Believe it or not, not really. Neither one of those hit me exactly right, but I appreciate both of their abilities.
Oh, okay. Well, Chrissy Everett, I know we spent a lot of time talking about Venus and Serena and how they came up, and they are on the list. But Chrissy Everett showed up. She made the finals in two majors at like 17. Lost in both those finals, came back at 18 and won both of them.
Yeah, but
and then she went on. This is the incredible stat. Then she went on and reached 52 of the 56 Grand Slams she played in. She reached at least the semifinals. 56 Grand Slam matches, and she made at least the semifinals in 52 of them. Absolutely brilliant career.
And
it started off as a kid. And she never let go.
But when you say as a kid, are we talking teenage, like teenage years? Are we talking when we first see them at 8 and 9 years old?
We're talking all of that. You know, we're talking, you know, depending upon the sport. Like, we don't know what Mike Tyson looked like at 8 or 9 years old. So he's on the list. So it just all depends.
He was knocking fools out. What you
mean? I was going to say scary and fast. And you didn't
watch number 8.
Number 8, Mike Tyson. Youngest heavyweight champion of the world. The only reason why he's not higher is because his reign was relatively short compared to some of the people who are ahead of him. But there's no question that when he was on fire, the sports world was his. I would argue there was a moment in which his mic was almost on par in terms of the amount of times that he showed up on SportsCenter and talked about as the other mic that we like to talk about.
Mm.
Like he was it. For, you know, a nice little window. But to me, the fact that he was a champ at 20, I just can't let that go.
Must see. There was not a fight he had that you could miss for the better part of 5 or 6 years. You had to see it.
Exactly. Number 7, arguably the greatest, not even arguably anymore, the greatest Olympian in the history of Olympics, Michael Phelps, showed up at the gate at 15 years old and medaled and didn't stop.
Right.
15 and just didn't stop. Every single time he dipped his toe in the water, it was basically everyone else saying, well, I can get silver. That's absolutely phenomenal. Number 6, LeBron James. LeBron James,
with
we
the
know,
first pick in the 2003 NBA draft, the Cleveland Cavaliers select LeBron James.
I mean, his story is about as storybook as you can possibly get. Sports Illustrated cover as a kid, you know, obviously won at the high school level, skipped over college, eventually won in the pros, and has basically been the sport's best player for at least a decade, at least. Not to mention everything that he does off the court, his leadership, just how he changed the NBA with the decision, which we're approaching the 10-year anniversary of. So just, yeah, what more can you say?
Mm-hmm.
Number 5. The sisters from Compton, Venus and Serena Williams.
Party sisters.
Man, you better have them other four better be high, boy.
If LeBron and the Williams sisters are in the middle.
Yeah, they better be good. But go on, it's your list. It's your list.
I mean, it is my list. Venus and Serena Williams, they became synonymous with so much. And they backed it up.
Don't give me a but.
I didn't. I just said they backed it up.
Yeah, but it was a pause in there. I thought you were about to say but.
No, I was just going to, like, you know, add on. They backed it up, and then they exceeded the backup. Like, if you just looked at Venus' career, and if they both had the exact same numbers as Venus' career, that would have been phenomenal. That would have been great. But what Serena was able to do is just take it to such an incredible level, people get mad and angry talking about it now. Because these two sisters from Compton came and took their sport.
Well, see, here's why it would be higher on my list. And I'm sorry, I know we got to move on with the thing, Raj, but it would be higher on my list because you took an African-American man who learned to coach tennis to his kids out of Compton off a book. He read a book, okay, to do this. Not only that, they also learned how to play doubles together and win titles. So, whatever, man, it's your list.
That's why their names are Venus and Serena, because I recognize the doubles part of it. But that's okay. Number four.
Nixon, Magic Johnson, and Kareem. Ford sends it to Kareem. Sky hook up and good. Lakers win. Score it. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Can anyone explain to me when's the last time Kareem lost? Bruce Lee. That was it. Since high school, this man has never lost. Just every single left. High school, UCLA, the Bucks, the Lakers. He sits on top of the list of the greatest scorers. People think that he's the greatest player of all time. This is a kid from Brooklyn that went on to become arguably the greatest of all time and literally did not have a pause in his winning. Why is he above LeBron James? Because it took LeBron James a minute to figure it out when he got to the NBA, and he doesn't have the resume of college that Kareem has because he skipped college, obviously. But Kareem parachutes into UCLA, and they don't lose.
Never.
Never.
Yeah, like three times.
It's like ridiculous. Number three.
All right.
Pele. Oh, so you know.
All right.
I just found out we don't.
It's only documentary sound we have.
All right.
He led Brazil to the World Cup at 17, dog, and then he didn't stop. He got two more. World Cup. He got two more. Not bad.
Not bad at all. But go ahead, man. We, you know.
Not bad at all.
We are in the United States, but go ahead.
He's in rap lyrics. Hey, LZ, he's in rap lyrics, and rappers don't know nothing about soccer.
Exactly. He's the only player in soccer that you can just say his name and people know who he is.
As he is.
All right.
Number two.
Well, who you got?
Yes.
I was going to say, I don't really think I need to explain.
You don't. You don't.
I mean,
yes.
It just kind of is what it is.
He was and famous then, at 4 years old.
He was famous at 4 years old. Matched and exceeded expectations. Absolutely phenomenal. But the number one phenom, in my humble opinion, came into the league as a teenager and instantly became the game's best player and basically didn't let go of that title for almost 20 years. They called him the Great One, and he certainly deserves the title.
Off Bart's shoulder in the corner, fired it in front. Here is an empty net chance for Gretzky with 5 seconds. He's moving in.
Marty McSorley?
Wayne Gretzky, baby. Gretzky. I mean, it is what it is. You can talk about his amateur career.
Everybody kind of like, yeah, well, good list, bad order, but okay.
No, I was good.
No. Good names on the list, but it's
Gretzky's the right choice. For me. Gretzky's
number one.
I'm a hockey fan, so I certainly appreciate
it. Me too.
That,
I'm a hockey fan too.
Wayne Gretzky has the most points in NHL history, and he's got 1,000 more than the next closest guy. Okay.
Travis, I didn't feel the need to explain Wayne Gretzky the key. I just figured he didn't know what Gretzky actually accomplished.
Man, I just right. What are you talking more. About, boy? I understand what he accomplished. I understand what he accomplished. I get that. I understand he was great and he scored and all that. And they protected him and Bernie Nichols. I get it. I understand all that.
When you look at the GOAT in every sport, he's not. No one's close to what Gretzky's accomplished in their sport.
And ain't no, like, and that's true. In every sport, Gretzky is one. He's an MVP. He's part of the crew. Right. But at the same time, I don't like the positioning. Everybody you named on those lists is great. I just don't like the positioning because the stories behind some of this stuff works better.
All right, J.R. Smith is going to be a member of the Lakers. Does he just drop right in and start knocking down threes? That's next on the Morning Show on 710 ESPN.